Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Law at the NYU School of Law, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Syria, international law, and war powers. So, Richard, since we've last gotten together, huge developments on the foreign affairs front. As part of the ongoing civil war in Syria, we saw a chemical weapons attack, appears to have been sarin gas, in the suburbs of Damascus. Death toll estimated to be over 1,400. And we'd seen evidence of chemical warfare in Syria earlier this year, but on a much smaller scale. And having something of this size has really sort of highlighted President Obama's pledge from last year that the use of chemical weapons would be a red line for him, that it would invite some sort of American response. And now you see the president trying to put together a limited offensive against Syria. So several things to talk about here. Let's first start with the special case of chemical weapons and how they're treated under international law. You've heard a lot of critics of intervention saying recently, well, what difference does it make? Even if we stop Assad from using chemical weapons, he's just going to slaughter people by more conventional means. So what do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think there's a great deal of truth to the argument, and the question is how it then relates to the scope of any kind of interventionist statement. If, in fact, the statement is true, as to a certain extent it is, then why is it that the red line is with the slaughter of civilians with chemical weapons, and why is not the red line the indiscriminate slaughter of individual innocent citizens by other means, guns, artillery, or whatever? And over that is going to be extremely important, because if the resolution goes through in the form in which it's currently drafted, to deal with respect to the future uses of chemical weapons or other weapons of mass destruction, there's going to be a lot of ambiguity in here, because you could stop the chemicals, you could stop the H-bombs, but you can't stop the shootings one after another on the theory that a Uzi or an AK-47 is not going to be treated as a weapon of mass destruction. So I think, in effect, the president drew the wrong red line, because the moment he put it up there, the critics all of a sudden now have a field day explaining that death is death and torture is torture and pain is pain, and that this system does not work. On the other hand, I understand where the president is coming from, and in foreign affairs generally tend to give presidents the benefit of the doubt. All of the treaties that are observed tend to isolate chemical weapons as being a distinct cast of situations, even in wartime. And again, you could see where that comes from. You can't tell people what we're going to do and outlaw in war is all use of deadly weapons. That kind of won't get a job done. So what they did is they managed to cabin these weapons off as opposed to other kinds of weapons, and said that when we run our international wars, a combination of moral sensibilities, the danger that the gas may come back into your own face, the fear of retaliation, has kept that norm pretty much in place. And if it keeps that norm in place, it probably will reduce to some extent the total number of deaths, because in fact, if guns were equally efficient with chemical weapons, then you would never see the need to use chemical weapons in the first place. So the president,
Richard, do you buy the argument that's made by some of the critics that if we don't take action here, that norm is weakened to the point of maybe just being abolished?
It seems to me it takes more than one flagrant disagreement or violation of a norm to call it to its end. But certainly it's going to start pushing things in that particular direction. The difficulty that one has, of course, is that the mechanism of retaliation, which is available when two sides are locked in combat, is not available in this particular case. There is nothing that the rebels can do and nothing that the dead civilians or even their relatives who are still alive can do in order to threaten chemical weapons from the other side. So now all you have is moral suasion. You're trying to do that against a moral animal, this guy Assad, who for whom you could say nothing nice. So I think, in effect, I understand where the president came from. But what was so terrible about his behavior before he went to Congress, and independent of that, is that this red line turned out to be a smudge on the page, because the moment it turned out that there was a violation, all the inquiry was, well, do we really have enough evidence to be sure that this stuff turns out to be true? And the moment you start introducing evidentiary doubts about this, what it does is it gives the people who want to oppose American intervention time to consolidate their opposition. And when they consolidate their opposition, what it does is it leaves the president more or less diplomatically isolated. And I think, in fact, that he's always had this tendency to try and be an advocate part of the time, but on the other time to be a kind of an independent moral conscience judging his own conduct. And so that you never have a guy who's going to consistently come out and say, I mean it's a red line, I want to do something about it, I'm reluctant to use force under ordinary circumstances, but when I give my word, I want to make sure to the rest of the world that my threats are in fact credible. And he's just done a huge amount of damage to his own credibility by the fact that he's been so indecisive on this particular matter. So it's not a question of whether or not he wants to go to Congress or not go to Congress. I think 6 months ago it would be perfectly clear to me that there was no moral compunction on the part of the Syrians to not use chemical weapons. And I think at that particular point what you want to do is to get your resolutions and congressional approvals in place early enough in the cycle so that when it happens, you don't have to go through this kind of public agony. What you do is you have a response that's in place. And it's that failure, I think, which will make us look very weak in the eyes of our allies and lead to a certain degree of diplomatic isolation.
Richard, you mentioned him bringing this resolution before Congress. This is something he did not do a couple of years ago in Libya. And this, of course, brings us to that old constitutional question of presidential war powers. And your friend and sparring partner, John Yoo, essentially says on this issue, president really doesn't have to get authorization from Congress. Congress basically has the power to stop the war by defunding it.
Yes.
Take us through the constitutional analysis on this question, also how it's subsequently colored by the War Powers Act. I mean, what, in your judgment, is the president's responsibility here as far as getting congressional buy-in?
This is one of the most difficult questions on the face of the globe. If you start looking at the original text of the Constitution, what it says is that the Congress shall have the power to declare war full stop. It doesn't say what the form of the declaration will have to be, but it's clear that an express declaration, which leaves no ambiguity, certainly satisfies the requirement, but it leaves open the question as to whether or not there's some kind of an implied declaration of war, which might be useful for tactical reasons in some cases, but not in others. If you then go that particular route, what you will say is that there's an implied declaration of war if it turns out that the Congress has made an appropriation which is sufficient to carry out the mission that the president wants to do. To which the response will then come, if it's a general appropriation which is not made with respect to this particular item, you could hardly treat that as an implied declaration because people had no idea that the money would be spent for these purposes. So that the reappropriation argument starts to gain credibility only in those cases like Vietnam or Korea, where what happens is you call this thing a police action and then Congress comes back and dutifully decides to fund the operation. And at that particular war point, I think John Yoo is right when he says there's an implied declaration of war under those circumstances and the president can keep going. But that leaves open the question, when he doesn't need the appropriation in order to act, can he do so independently? And I think the answer to that question is probably no if you want to do this as a matter of text. There are passages in the Constitution which talk about the way in which states engage in war against one another, which make no reference whatsoever to the distinction between the power to declare war and the ability to carry the thing out. But that's because what you're trying to do is to stop states from fighting, and you're not trying to tell them how they run their internal constitutions. So the point on the U.S. side, which is always strongest, is if you go back to the shores of Tripoli, not a couple of years ago when the president intervened in Libya, but back to the time when Jefferson was president, a lot of those things were military actions of a modest scope which were undertaken without congressional approval. So you then have this constant problem of what's the relationship between what I like to call the prescriptive constitution, the evolving constitution, and the textual constitution. This is at the core of the debate, for example, over the recess appointment, where the Democrats want to say, look, we've been doing it like this way for, you know, 150, 200 years. Why are you telling us the fact that the text doesn't match the practice, that we have to follow the text? And so I think, in effect, that there's probably, let me put it this way, at the least, very least, strong prudential reasons to get this stuff. It's probably, in my view, unconstitutional, notwithstanding the practice, but that's obviously debatable. But it's also, if unconstitutional, the kind of thing which is not going to be subject to adjudication in the courts, because they have rightly taken the position that they're small fry in this kind of battle, and the president and the Congress have to fight this thing out as they see fit. What he's decided to do is to basically take the safe course, which he did not do in Libya, and try to get the approval. And the danger of this is that he has a sufficiently limited general mission that he may commit something. Something may happen in response, which will require perhaps a broader and more thorough response. And the president then is going to have to decide whether to get new authorization, which is extremely costly if you're in the middle of a crisis, or go at it by himself. So I think the problem with the president is not that he's seeking congressional approval. I think that he boxed himself in by the way in which he handled this thing up to the very recent time.
Let's talk about this whole situation from the libertarian perspective. Mm-hmm. There's a growing sense, particularly in recent years, with the visibility of people like Ron Paul and Rand Paul, that there is a firm libertarian ideology on foreign policy, and it runs roughly as follows. You'll engage the outside world for trade and diplomacy, but you'll basically avoid military conflict in all situations except for those where there's a direct, tangible, and fairly imminent threat to national security interests. But it tends to be uncomfortable with our global reach, with the number of bases that we keep overseas, in some cases with the size of the military, with surveillance on civil libertarian grounds. Now, let me quote you to yourself from a Defining Ideas column back in June of this year. You wrote on matters of foreign policy, quote, "Libertarians can both be faithful to their basic principles, yet differ strongly on what should be done. The basic principle of libertarian thought is its blanket prohibition against the use of force, including the threat of force and fraud, to achieve personal gain at the expense of others. That principle translates easily into the international context to say that one nation cannot wage war against another. However easy it is to state that basic principle, however, it is just that hard to implement it." That does not sound to me like someone who thinks that the views of Ron Paul or Rand Paul are the only legitimate foreign policy ideology for libertarians.
Yeah. Well, yes, I do disagree with them. I disagree with them fairly emphatically, in fact. What happens is the way in which I would put it is that there's no situation apart from the defense of the United States where the government is obliged to use force. But that doesn't mean that when you start looking at the larger panoply of interest out there that you're not allowed to use force to help somebody else. The libertarian theory, when it applies to given individuals, it always takes the particular form, and it's pretty clear, that if A is attacking B, and you know that A is the attacker, you may intervene to help B if you happen to be C, but B cannot sue you if you don't. So essentially what happens is you have the right to intervene, but you don't have the duty to intervene. So then the libertarians actually have to face something which they try not to do in political theory, which is to exercise their own judgment as to whether or not they go in. And to give you an idea of how dangerous I think that the double Paul position turns out to be is, you know, you go back and make the year 1938 and imagine that your friend Hitler has now entered into Austria or into Czechoslovakia or is about to threaten Poland. And if you ask yourself the question as to whether or not a land law on the Polish-German border is something which is a direct or imminent threat to the United States, the answer to that question is no. And so Roosevelt essentially was mistaken with respect to Lend-Lease, perhaps, and surely was mistaken in trying to get ourselves closer to the allies in those cases. I think, in fact, if there's something to be learned from the history of World War II, it may be that we almost waited too long before I got ourselves involved. And of course, if you take the Ron Paul type situation, you're not even quite sure how we would handle the intermediate case that came up there, namely, for example, the Lend-Lease agreement that we made with Britain in 1940, which was credited with giving them just enough sea power so as to be able to avoid some of the worst consequences after Dunkirk and so forth. Is that going to be an entanglement with a foreign nation even though we don't fire bullets, or is that going to be regarded as mere diplomatic action? It's not clear. So I think, in effect, we have to be a little bit more muscular on that question, and we have to say, well, you know, whenever we get involved in some of these cases, there are risks, and we have to take those into account, but there are also benefits. And one of the benefits I think that we should take into account is to be a little bit less indifferent about the slaughter of innocent lives of people who live in strange places who speak a language that we really don't understand very well. And my own view with respect to that stuff is, in Syria, I think it would be perfectly appropriate for us to intervene. And one of the reasons why I'm a little bit saddened by what the president has done is that I think that the delays that we've seen in interventions have, in effect, reduced to some extent the viable set of options that we now have. I think the longer you wait, the less people are confident that you're going to come in. They tend to gravitate away from you, and now you have to win them back, and that makes it the case that the delay in effect makes the intervention more uncertain and less effective.
All right, Richard Epstein, thank you as always. And a reminder to our listeners, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by going to hoover.org and clicking on Defining Ideas. And you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. Thank you for listening.